Hello, you're listening to a spoiler-filled film conversation. Hooray!
The Omega Man. That's what we're doing this time on the podcast. Hello, it's me, Richard, the Beta Man, and with me is the Alpha Female, Abigail Bain,
Hello.
and the Ceta Male, Anthony.
Hi.
Shut up! Know your place. So this week, guys, I picked the Omega Man. So there you go. Now you know. Now you know. I'm not going to give the details. So I'll leave it to Alpha Female to do that because she's in charge now. Go.
Omega Man is from 1971. It was directed by Boris Siegel, written by John William Corrington, Joyce Hopper Corrington, based on the novel by Richard Matheson. Stars Charlton Heston, Anthony Zerbe, Rosalind Cash, Paul Coslow, Eric Lunneville, and Lincoln Kilpatrick. And it's about a lone survivor, Dr. Robert Neville, struggling to create a cure for the plague that's wiped out most of the human race while fighting the family, a savage Luddite death cult formed by the zombie-like infected to erase the past.
Yes, it is, I suppose. So I hadn't seen this that recently. Like, I've discovered it in the last few years, and I think the only reference I'd sort of remember, coming across was there's a Halloween Simpsons episode that has a segment called the Homega Man, where it, like, clearly references
Oh, yeah.
this Charlton Heston gem.
I remember that.
I think that's very famous. I think that's like a really good, that's like good era Simpsons as well. But I mean, that's not, I didn't really watch it because of that or anything. I love the fucking 70s in terms of cinema. And this was another one, and I was like, oh, this sounds like a fucking right hoot, doesn't it? We did a podcast of The Quiet Earth, some similar premise elements to that, where it's basically the lone man in a derelict world, and the sort of the person surviving on their own in isolation to some extent. I mean, he does have spooky albino ghouls in it or whatever. But I like that idea of the last man on Earth thing. Actually, the sitcom The Last Man on Earth is pretty good, of what I've seen. But that's a premise that intrigues me. I love the 70s, and then, as far as Charlton Heston goes, like, people know him for these like kind of biblical epics like Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments and stuff. And people have him down as this legendary actor. But actually, I think he does a lot of B movies, especially through the 70s. He's done a lot of work, and I think, like, he's done some great work, but he's also done like Planet of the Apes and stuff, hasn't he? So, bit of a
Most
different.
people would consider that good.
Most people would consider Being Moses good, but I don't give a shit about the Ten Commandments per se. Not a terrible film I say adaptation. I mean, I don't remember the Ten Commandments that. I mean, I remember the Ten Commandments. They're classics. Who isn't Christian? God, I'm getting so sidetracked by this. It's so unnecessary. Anyway, Charlton Heston's an odd actor because he's thought of in high regard, but I don't think people have seen like the bulk of his catalogue. I haven't either, but he crops up a lot over here and there, old Charlton. And I don't know. We'll see if we decide he was good or bad in this. I think he's certainly interesting, like the way he portrays Neville, the main character, is kind of awesome, but also kind of awful at the same time.
I know what you mean.
Like, there's a couple of points, like one of the, he's doing quips throughout this, like, because he's
Oh,
always,
so many one-liners.
yeah, and it's kind of fun, but also there's a, like, I think he jokes with one of the other actors. I think there's a character called Lisa in it. She turns up and they make some fucking joke, and they're doing the worst fake laughing. Oh no, she says, because they've had sex later in the film, and then they're in like a dusty old chemist looking for some supplies, and she's like, contraceptives? We don't need those. I don't need like the morning after pill, because the apocalypse. And oh my god. Oh, they have a right holler and hoot about it. And it's like, oh my god.
I think that's probably the best time to have birth control. 6-year-old?
Yeah, no. You wouldn't want to be giving birth to children in that situation.
Yeah. It's a nice contrast of the incredible bleak situation they're in and the fact that, yay, two humans have had sex again, even though there's hardly any left in the world. But yeah, I don't know. I like the corniness of it sometimes. But then, I don't know, is he giving it more gravitas than it deserves? Because it's a very, very cheap-feeling film. I don't know. So I needed other people to weigh in on this, because I like it, but I don't at the same time. It has potential, and yet, does it?
Well, my thing, the whole thing is sitting under the shadow of Charlton Heston's involvement with the NRA.
Oh, right. Well, all real life things to do with actors spoil things, I find.
Because it's very much about the sort of the myth of the gun comes in and just the sort of the casualness of it all. It troubles me.
It is in a way a film that is an advert for why even at the end of days you need the gun. It's obviously about violence and using machines and things to, you know, it's all about how machines have been the downfall of man, but for Charlton Heston's character they're semi the reason he's still alive, and yet they end, you know, like it's about weaponry and it's about man's ability to make killing machines, I suppose. And so what you're saying is Charlton Heston was a big gun nut or something, was he?
Yeah, he was the president of the NRA for a very long time. Oh, he only really stopped when his health gave out when he was a very old man.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't love I don't agree with the politics of the NRA, but I respect the fact that guns are fun. Like, I get that. You know, it is fun. If you're shooting a target, you're not doing anyone any harm, but people do like to carry guns around to protect themselves, and then you go, I don't know, are there any cardboard cutout targets coming at you? No, because if it's a human, you don't want to be shooting them unless it's absolutely necessary. And even then, probably just be shot to death, I think. It'd be safer world if people just accepted their death. I mean, we can't really worry about people's real-life politics, because then, you know, we'd never get anywhere talking about films, would we? I wasn't thinking about what Charlton Heston might want this film to be as an advert for guns. Because, you know, no spoilers, like, he dies. So, thanks to a spear, a different kind of machine, but a weapon of death made by man, technically, and a pointy stick, so it's pretty basic. But yeah, so, you know, I don't know. Maybe it'll cut out the themes of the violence and things. And But yeah, Abby, had you seen this before then?
No, generally speaking, I've avoided Charlton Heston films, not because of Charlton Heston, but they're usually just like he does a lot of Bible films, not interested. And then he does, when they're not Bible films, they're still 4 hours long, not interested. So the fact that this was a reasonably length film that wasn't some kind of swords and sandals was a relief, really.
Yeah. So what films have you seen before now featuring the Heston?
I will have a quick look, but I'm fairly sure the answer is none.
Not even like Planet of the Apes?
No.
You've seen Ben-Hur, surely?
No.
He's the narrator in the Disney Hercules?
Is he?
I think. If memory serves. He'd have cropped up somewhere.
Green?
Have you seen Soylent Green? This is in the same sort of wheelhouse, I would have thought, Soylent Green.
Nope.
Oh, well. So,
I'm working on it. I'm looking. But, I don't know. Talk to Anthony for a minute and I'll get back to
you. The Three Musketeers. Three Musketeers.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Cardinal something or other, is it?
Richelieu.
Okay, so you have experienced him in one way or another.
Oh, and A Touch of Evil as well. I lied.
He's Mexican in that, is he?
Yeah, in a thing I read just now when I wanted to check about John Heston and the NRA, apparently he got really offended when he was barred from playing a Eurasian role, which I think means yellow face, and he said it was racist for them to not let him do it. I was like,
what is Eurasian? That can't be Chinese or Japanese? What? Eurasian? What's that?
Because Asia is so big, it's split up, and Eurasia is the Europe side of Asia.
And he was like, "Oh, it's racist for being an opera player."
I think that was what, but that was very late in his career, and I'm not sure he was well.
I don't know. It's always, even to this day, you go, "Oh, do you need Egyptians? Get the British in." You know, it happens all the time with movies. I mean, sometimes, you know, I think generally the consensus is you probably shouldn't be putting, you shouldn't be browning up for anything, but then Ben Kingsley played Mahatma Gandhi, so, you know, times ain't changing that quickly. I don't mind, I don't care. I'm not going to be, oh, that's awful, I can't watch a film because someone played a different race to what they maybe should have.
Oh, there's Hugh Tombstone, don't remember. And he's in True Lies, and I don't remember that either. It's, apparently, I watch films with him in, and I just don't remember that he's in them.
Because you haven't watched Ben-Hur. If you see Ben-Hur, you go, oh yeah, Charlton Heston, isn't it? And then you spot him on your radar, you know?
Hmm.
Anthony, have you seen many things with a Hess in?
I've seen Planet of the Apes.
Not a Ten Commandments fan.
I don't think I've watched it all. I don't think I've watched it, but it's one of those ubiquitous things of you've probably seen the whole thing in bits through the years because it's on TV all the time.
Right.
Same with Ben-Hur. I haven't technically watched the whole thing, but I probably have through the years, if you know what I mean. I did watch Soylent Green, but I don't really remember it all that much because I think I was a bit too young and it was just boring to my young self.
Sure.
That's all I can remember.
That's okay.
Like, yeah, like I've seen like True Lies and I've seen Hercules, but I don't really remember him being in them, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. It's just got one of those names, one of those like heralded, and then you go, you know, it's not, you know, don't haven't seen that many of his films, but yeah, oh yeah, Charlton Heston, of course. And maybe not, of course. But I don't know. What were you expecting from this then, Anthony?
Well, I've read the book it was based on, I Am Legend.
Well, no,
it was a while ago in my youthful days. I haven't picked up a book in years, no.
No, it's just we never actually get to talk about the book. This isn't speculate on the book, this is talk about the book time.
Although we won't really be talking about the book because
it's a big departure, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, the general premise is the same, but there are so many little points changed that it's practically a completely different movie. So I might bring it up just to go, like, you know, a general, well, this didn't happen, it was more like this, but I'll leave it for the most part. But I like the book, is the point. And do you remember the Will Smith I Am Legend?
I remember it existing, and I remember very much not ever going to see it.
That's a little bit closer in the fact that it involves vampires instead of just
Halloween weird albinos.
Yeah, ghouls, as they're called in all the bump I'm reading about the film.
I would call them ghouls because they are hooded, vague monsters of some sort.
They're monks. They're kind of monks of the night, albino monks.
With scabs. Scabby albino monks with a sort of a cult of anti machinery, and they're kind of the Amish. I don't know.
But I didn't enjoy I Am Legend that much because, like I said, it kind of departs from the book, and the main things I liked about the book didn't quite transfer well into that adaptation. So I was hoping there'd be more of them in this one. And there are, it does touch upon the good themes of the book, but it is, like, they've changed so much that it really doesn't really represent. So I guess that's why they changed the name, because it is essentially
its own
quite
thing.
The step apart from it, yeah. But no, I was quite excited, because I think I'm also a fan of, like, Last Man on Earth things. I think it's one of those fantasy things where it's like, oh, I've been granted total freedom. What would I do? Kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's always nice to think about. And then after a while, you'd be like, well, a week of that would be fine. And then after a while, you would be hearing telephones ring like Charlton Heston in this. And you'd be... I was trying to think whether... Do you know, like, if you're the only person alive and the world is empty and you can play in it, you could sleep anywhere you want, but you wouldn't feel comfortable because it would be so quiet. And that's still that instinctive, there could be a threat thing. And then you'd wake up and you'd hear noises, and you'd be forever chasing noises that didn't get caused by humans, and you'd go mental so quickly, don't you think?
Yeah, maybe.
But you do, like me, you're like, oh, I like the idea of seeing someone play around in an empty world, doing whatever they want. And
yeah, so I thought I'd like it because of that, and because it was based on some good source material, and like it's a 70s weird-looking sci-fi thing.
Yeah.
Probably have something I'd like.
It's sort of in a wheelhouse of interest, at least.
Mm. Kind of in between, actually. Kind of, it still has quite a few 60s remnants, but you can also see like where the 70s are starting as well.
Yeah, definitely. So, let's go through the film for a bit and, you know, see what crops up as interesting talking points. So the opener is essentially quite a cool shot of a city with devoid of moving vehicles and people. Like, it's just empty and has, whenever they seem to decorate the empty streets of what I think is Los Angeles, they seem to just strew a bit of paper and the odd bit of furniture or crashed car somewhere and say, look, it's abandoned. We have a nice shot of a car on its own, tooling around, and some nice music playing on the radio. Seems radio works somehow in the car. Don't know why. I don't know how it works.
Oh, he plugs it. He puts like a cassette in, doesn't he? So.
Oh, okay, yeah. I accept that. It's just for a second there. It couldn't make sense.
What were they called? Like the huge cassettes that were like the size of VHS?
8-track?
Don't know.
Sure, I don't know, but it was one of those, you know, it kind of looked like a bloody Atari cartridge going in there, like.
Oh, yeah, no problems yet. But, you know, he's, like, Charlton Heston is in his kind of urban safari wear, I guess. He's got, like, a kind of beige all-purpose jacket coat thing on and a machine gun on a strap around with him, and he's got like a gun in a holster as well, and he's just like practical, casual kind of, you know, look. It isn't Hawaiian shirts yet, or I say yet. He's not like fully casual. No one could hurt me. I can walk around naked if I want. Although he's very topless in this film, like a lot for an older guy to be topless this much. It feels like either Charlton Heston insisted upon it, or the director fancied him or something. Like, I don't know. Maybe, is it meant to appeal to like a GILF-loving audience?
I would say it plays more into his casualness, because I've heard a lot of people say that when they're in their own house on their own, they prefer not to wear a top.
And if it's the end of the world, you're the only proper human left alive. Fuck it, isn't it?
Mm. It certainly fits in with that, yeah.
Yeah, it just felt it was odd, like, with his grandpa tits out all the time. I was like, okay, I don't know.
Our view, I think, of masculinity has just changed over the decades. And whilst that might have been something more sexually appealing, I think it's more just a change in tastes over the years.
I don't know. Not that I'm being like a prude or anything. I just thought it was odd that it was. There was times where, well, there's no need for him to be topless now, is there? I don't know. But it's good. It's better than having ladies forced to be topless in these like violent pics. Like you know, stuff like Death Wish, where they like, it's a woman being murdered. She better have her tits out. Like, I feel like sometimes the 70s was like any excuse to get ladies naked. So Charlton Heston, being an older actor at this point, being topless, is kind of one for equality in a way, you know?
You had weird ribs. That's coming from me. Okay. I've got weird ribs.
Yeah. No harsh judgment here, though. I don't mind or care. I just thought it was odd. But it's, you know, maybe it's no big deal. But, you know, we established that Charlton Heston as Neville is tooling around his own. It's quite a nice few jokes at the beginning, which made me start to really enjoy the film. So we established the spookily eerie silent city with a car driving through it, and then essentially he crashes because, I don't know, there's some shit in the way, and he comes across like a fucking botched gold heist or something, where everyone's dead in the road. And he just kind of shrugs it off and, you know, says some quip about, oh, there's never any police around when you need them or whatever.
You don't get a real sense of his strangeness, though, until he starts talking to that dead car salesman.
Yeah, because he's ruined his tyre, isn't he? So he's like, he pops into the nearest car dealership that's all dusty and, you know, abandoned, apart from a corpse in a chair. And yeah, he has a little... what I liked about the joke, so he doesn't just help himself to this car... But like you say, he talks to himself and makes jokes as if he's having a conversation with the car salesman. And he can't get a good deal on it. I like that he feels like he's being robbed. And it's like, oh, so getting this dusty Cadillac or whatever. And can't even get a good price on it. And I'm stealing it. So, look. I enjoyed that stuff, though. I like Charlton Heston having a little chat with himself. You know, the quips are what make it really fun. Even if they are occasionally a little corny.
Yeah, I did, after a while, found it a bit distracting.
Maybe forced occasionally.
Yeah, because it just felt a bit unnatural, but then, you know, it's an odd situation, I suppose. Hmm. But it didn't bother me too much, and then more people started coming in, and then it wasn't really a problem anymore, so...
Yeah, because, you know, you got to get a balance. Like, so something like Die Hard is quite a mad premise, but... All the quips seem like they suit John McClane as a character.
Mm.
Don't feel unnatural. And then sometimes in this, the stuff Neville says does feel a little bit forced, but I'd rather have a joke than just... Because you're never going to take this movie 100% seriously because of the sort of explanation for why everything's kind of kaput and empty.
Mm.
But Charlton Heston picks up his new car and... Does he go to the films and stuff? Like, do you go to the movie at this point? Or is he?
He goes and watches Woodstock, doesn't he? In the cinema.
Yeah. They have the nice joke of like, oh, this is in for the third year in a row or whatever.
Mm.
The way he talks along with it as well, with his frightening teeth.
Yeah, and he's just miming some random... Because if it was like an iconic line, you'd be like, oh, he really likes this random film of a festival. I guess it's, you know, the film choice is partly the era, but also to show he's watching a film that has crowds of people and music, and it must be what he's missing from his life. But also it's whatever's projecting that day that the world came to a stop. But I like, he's mouthing perfectly some random garbling from some stoner being interviewed and stuff, and... It's nice. It's a nice kind of look into what Charlton Heston would do with his time. Let's see the Woodstock hundreds of times because it's...
Yeah.
I don't know if he knows how to change the projection or he wants that particular... He doesn't look like he's into the kind of festival vibe, but it changes a man, doesn't it?
Knowing Charlton Heston's politics, that would be the opposite of what he'd want to be watching.
Yeah, maybe so.
Take what you can get in the apocalypse.
That's it, it changes you.
The one thing I'd say about this scene is, and I'm only saying this because it doesn't really happen in the rest of the film, and I was kind of like expecting it because of the type of film it is. This is the only point where I'm like, well, how would he make the movie go without electricity?
I guess he hooks up a kind of generator in the back.
Maybe.
Depending on where they are, if it is Los Angeles, don't they have... A lot of places have emergency generators because of the earthquakes.
Ooh.
Maybe.
It is one of the things.
I don't bring it up because it's like distractingly awful or anything, but given the type of movie it is, like I said, you'd find kind of little inconsistencies like that. And considering this was the only one I really remember, you know, that's pretty good.
There are, I think, other things you could question. But it is basically explained with generators, with petrol in and things. And It's like, if this sort of thing happens, you think, oh, all the luxuries you'd have to sort of set up. Like, one of the obvious things is flushing toilets would be gone, so you'd just be, the world is your toilet after that, but you would miss running water, wouldn't you, as an option, and, not just have to find, not have to source it wherever you can. But,
I think he fills up, like, a water tank on his roof at some point.
Yeah, so, he has...
They do address these things. They do show him, like, turning on the generator and, filling it up with stuff. And for the most part, that's it. That's all the electricity, because all of the ghouls are essentially, religious Puritans,
yeah.
I suppose. And they don't have anything. They all have fire and candles and stuff. So it just kind of dodges that. And it's not a distraction. I think they do well to keep it consistent.
Yeah,
and not have you questioning all the little things, like.
It does, on the most part, work for me. I'm not going through it with a fine tooth comb, but it's fine. And his approach to his day to day going about, and you don't realise till later on that he's partly exploring the city to look for the nest of people of the family, who is the monsters that he has to deal with. And so, he's having a bit of fun and tooling around and stuff, he's also sort of potentially ticking off locations where he, isn't finding these people who are a threat to him in the night time. But the other thing that happens early on is he kind of hallucinates that all the phones of the city are ringing, and he has to sort of scream at himself that it's not ringing. And so it does give us some insight that he's going mad. He's not just talking to himself for fun. He is actually, losing it, which, is perfectly acceptable given the mad circumstances.
Yeah, especially as we're introduced to him so casually as well. Like, he's extremely casual in his behaviour and the way he's quipping against everything. So, like, when it's good to be reminded that this is a reaction to the loneliness.
Yeah, and I think he sees some hooded person in, like, a office window that he machine guns at. So we get the sense that something is dangerous and out there. He's very calm and casual because it's the daytime most of the, time, I guess. But he carries guns with him, and he's got, he's sensibly sort of bringing a canister of petrol in case he needs to change cars or something, or power something up in some way, like a cinema. So he's prepared, but, like, laid back and sort of just living, and he's got a fairly modest setup. So, considering most people would be, a bit hack and move into the biggest mansion or the White House, or you'd live somewhere fun or like a mall or something, wouldn't you? He is living in his actual original address, which is like a flat on a three-story building or something, isn't he?
Mm.
What do you guys make of Neville's house setup?
Yeah, it was nice.
I liked his buddy.
Caesar.
Oh, yes. Mm. That was... They did a really good job of getting him to talk. Otherwise, it would just be silence for ages.
Mm. And it was well thought out as a location as well. Like I said, they sold it as, well, this would be a really good stronghold for him. With all, like, the floodlights and you have to take the elevator to the top kind of thing.
Yeah, and, like, he's got his garage ground floor entrance for his whatever car he's driving. And he's got, like, a locked-up store of petrol and where the generator is. And kind of all the practical things are locked up nice and safe and tight. And as you say, you elevate it to your actual, his apartment. Where, you can understand someone wanting to live where they've always lived, I guess. And then it's for, it's like, as you mentioned, Abby, he's got a bust of Julius Caesar with a general's cap on that he plays chess with. I don't know quite how Caesar moves the pieces, but it must happen at some point.
And just lots of expensive looking stuff around.
Yeah, he's got walls full of. Kind of, go on, sorry.
That you can just kind of assume he's picked up over the years and brought them home, kind of thing.
Yeah, he's got his little treasure trove of crap and antiques, and yeah, like wallfuls of presumably paintings from museums and things, and famous artwork and antiques, And then, you know, the obligatory canned foods. Like, he's got a cupboard full of canned foods. And I don't quite... I don't know what these sausages are. He cooks sausages for himself at one point with some... For a meal. And you go, I don't know if they'd survive this long. Like, a few years into the apocalypse now.
Yeah. It's like, well, unless the ghouls have, like, you know, started butchery again. Like,
oh, God, yeah. I mean,
those are probably rotten sausages.
Yeah, I mean, there might be some animals that have survived, but you're not processing them as sausages, are you? So, yeah, I don't know why he's got big, old, chunky boiled sausages to eat, but he's got his food, you know, sauce, and, you know, he's living in a modest but lavish way, and he's got all the fancy cognacs and booze that he wants. He's got... his little friend, Caesar, who, as you say, Abby, is like a good tool to get him talking, isn't it?
Yeah, and it helps to keep him sympathetic as well, because he's got all of that stuff and wealth, even though it's meaningless. Like, you don't feel like he's really suffering that much, so he could be quite difficult to be sympathetic to.
Yeah, and... I think the key to this, then, we should talk about the main threat he has, because he's the only normal bloke alive, as far as he knows. So the problem is, at night time, you can't just, you know, sleep in a bed shop, wherever you fancy, with your balls out. You might get killed by, you know, horrible people who've survived the apocalypse. Essentially, I guess we have to talk about the plague that's happened. It's quite... quite the tale. So, I'll paraphrase as best I can. There's a war in the sort of history of this film, anyway. Russia and China have a falling out, and there's some kind of germ warfare that then affects the whole world. So that war becomes irrelevant as a virus, like a kind of plague-like virus, is striking everyone ill and dead. So people are dying left, right, and centre. It becomes a massive global epidemic. There's, like, the remaining, like, people on the news, including the head of now the survivors, I guess, who's, like, an evil sort of cult leader. The news guy is actually, what's his name, Matthias. Did you guys notice that?
Mm.
Yeah.
I didn't notice the first time I watched the film. It was only upon watching it for this. So I was like, oh, God, that's him. But, you know, people are reporting on the situation getting worse and worse. And essentially... people have really comical, like, oh, I'm dead and I'm going to pull a funny face and die in my chair. We've got a whole montage of, like, people dying and pulling faces and get coughing and falling to the ground. But, you know, comedy plague ensues and kills everyone, except it doesn't kill everyone, does it? It also leaves some people all albinoified, sensitive to light, scabby. And I don't know if it's just Matthias's teachings that... create people to be anti the future, machines and stuff. I'm not sure if it's just meant to be Matthias teaches people that, or if part of the plague is you hate machines. I guess it can't be, because there's that one guy, there's an off-road albino guy, isn't there? And he wants to use a gun to get Neville. But Matthias is like, no, that's evil. Guns are bad. What do you guys think? Is it part of the plague that you don't like cars and stuff?
I don't think it's like... I think that's, again, it's a reaction. You know, essentially they've all mutated into a different species, and then it's kind of like bringing in religious aspects of, oh, why has this happened? This is clearly what was meant to happen. Why did this happen? Because technology... got out of hand, so we need to become Luddites again, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think the ghouls are both the best and the worst part of the movie. I like, because once we're introduced to them, especially after like the first kind of really casual 10 minutes, and then you are... like, I think the first time you see them, they jump him as he's coming in to his
lair.
Garage. Yeah, his lair. The Heston lair. And, like, he guns them down. But
there's
like,
fire everywhere as well. Like, they chuck, like, flames and stuff at his car. and they jump, like as you say, they jump him, and he sort of shoots a few and fights them off and gets in his garage.
And it's well done, you know, it's quick, it's a proper ambush, it's, you know, they're throwing Molotov cocktails straight away, and then he has to gun them down.
Yeah, these ain't your brain-dead zombies.
And then he turns on the light, and you see that you see a few of them kind of like scuttling away, which I liked. But I think they're the best part because they embody the themes that I like from the book the most. Because in the book, they're not. Well, they're supposed to be vampires. So there's a lot of, you know, classic vampire stuff going on, like garlic and mirrors and crosses and all that stuff.
All right.
But essentially, they're just normal-looking humans, maybe a bit pale, who come out at night.
Goths.
Yeah, and there's kind of... I'll just go into it a bit. There's two different kinds. There's reanimated vampires, who are a bit more feral and violent. And then there's like the people who just are diseased, and they're more normal. But we don't really learn that until later on in the book, because he just kind of classes them all as one thing. But in this film, I like it because was this before or after like Night of the Living Dead? I think it would have been after,
Night of the Living Dead was before, yeah.
But, like, that's... It's the start of these monsters representing something bigger to society.
They're not just an angry mob. They have a kind of metaphorical message. And also they sort of have belief system. It's not just, I want to eat brains. They don't care about that. They want to kill Neville because, to them, he's the odd one out and the freak.
And that's... And that's one of the strongest parts of the novel is the by the end, the perspective has shifted and it's like, well, actually, he's the kind of bad guy because he's just indiscriminately going around killing them all. So I like it in this film that they're more organized and they have an agenda and it's less feral I just like that. It's like you never really see that in monster movies kind of thing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Their disadvantage is essentially they're light sensitive and can't come out during the day or be in too bright a light. So they're weaker than Neville, who's a healthy person. And they're probably grotesque and horrible looking, but they still have... There's more of them, and therefore, you know, if they're smart enough, they should be able to get him. But then the technology cult stops them from using weapons. It'd be fairly easy to kill Neville if they, you know, wanted to. We're using things more than just, you know, fiery trebuchets and things, or sticks, or flaming torches. So those limitations are there to stop them being a massive problem, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. And that's why they're kind of like the best thing about it. But then they're also kind of the worst thing because... aesthetically, they look really goofy a lot of
the
time. That's
the thing, isn't it? Part of my problem with the whole concept, other than, okay, I get it, germ warfare, that's fine, there's an apocalypse, we may all still die if some virus mutates, or, you know, we could all easily die from bugs and germs and stuff, or warfare, or, you know, I'm okay with that, but what is this disease that kills most people, but then some people are left as kind of zombified scabby albinos who are light sensitive, like actual albinos, I guess, but more light sensitive, and they become more, like, they do become a little bit more feral, I think, is the idea. But then also a few kids and a young medical student and a lady and Charlton Heston is the only one who's had like a vaccine or whatever, so, but like a small group of people have survived. I mean, it could be representative of more people in the world, but randomly some young people haven't got ill and died or have become these freaky ill people. So why do some go on.
I'm trying to remember which one it is, that people attribute part of the vampiric myth to, I think it's syphilis. Ooh. And what it does to people, which it includes light sensitivity, you become pale, all that stuff, but you don't necessarily die from syphilis.
So you're saying the people who have become living zombie type people are the ones who had syphilis, so they survived a bit and didn't die of the plague? What are you saying? Or just that is kind of like the disease the family have.
Yeah, and that they may yet succumb to it, but they haven't.
Yeah, I mean, but it's a bit confusing. Like, there's no obvious reason. It's not like, oh, young people, it's not like all children survive, but, you know, they end up dying because people either kill them or they can't survive. But, like, just a very small random group are living. And then Charlton Heston has the ridiculous, he's the one convenient man who was working on a vaccine, I guess, when the news broke that people were dying everywhere. So he's, like, working in a military facility, and then he's got a potential, like, vial of antidote or whatever, or vaccine. And then his pilot gets sick and dies, and they crash, and somehow the crash, huge explosion, and he's just all torn to shreds and covered in red paint, and crawls free and injects himself with this remedy that could easily not work and could not save him. But it does, because it's the one last working vial of special vaccine. And he's now immune, but everyone else in the world is, except a handful of people who are randomly fine and will eventually. So the other people in it who aren't part of the family and aren't albinos, they still live in Los Angeles, but they live up in the hills away from Neville.
Mm.
And they just haven't crossed paths, so he thinks he's alone.
They do say they've been watching him from a distance, but because of his erratic behaviour.
His penchant for shooting away the fuck out of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't want to be mistaken for the family and shot dead. Like, there's this psychotic scientist guy living in, like, his flat. We're just going to give him a wide berth, and, you know, they save him at one point, so, you know. It becomes more interesting. Like all Last Man on Earths, people have to write in other characters, because if you have a Last Man on Earth story, it happens in Last Man on Earth. So many characters appear in that. The Quiet Earth, again, he thinks he's alone, but he's not. And people can't help themselves. Like, you have to write in other characters, or it is super boring. You know, it's just one man wanking and shooting things wherever he wants. Like, it's literally a boring story without other people, isn't it? You can never truly do this kind of thing. But, you know.
That's just an unfortunate limitation of the premise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like you say, Anthony, I think you've hit the nail on the head saying they're both the best thing and the worst. Because conceptually, the family, this diseased cult that are led by an ex-newsreader who, you know, he's probably disenfranchised. He's seen what's happened, like the apocalypse has happened, and he's sort of taken it in. And he's come to the reasonable conclusion that the reason why we all killed ourselves with a warfare and basically our inventions are the things that led us to kill each other en masse. So we should stop that world. We should go back to the kind of primal times and survive in a more natural way. That's his idea. And he's got a bunch of followers. All the people who have become ill have kind of listened to him, I guess, give speeches or something. And he's got a group of people all working under him. He's got a kind of rudimentary cult of hooded, albino, scabby people who believe that you shouldn't use weapons and technology because that's what killed all of the rest of the people. And that because Neville's the only one now who isn't ill like them, and he's also killing them indiscriminately because they're dangerous, that he's the enemy and needs to be stopped. And once he's dead, they can go on. Like, life can continue then, and just, you know, we'll flip to working nights only and go back to, like, you know, cooking things at a campfire, isn't it? That's the plan, anyway, from Matthias, the head of the family.
Yeah, and that's kind of essentially what happens in the book, is they are rebuilding society, like, where they can, but they have this, you know, demon man who comes out during the day hunting them and trying to kill them.
But then the thing that sucks is, because it's like a limited, like, the film, I guess, one of the limitations is the effect is all these quite stupid looking, like, I think obviously it's like meant to be a mix of races. Like, everyone's white now, like bleached and white, and even like black people are white and their hair's changed. And so everyone, and they're a little bit, you know, ugly and scabby or whatever, their eyes have changed and things. But, you know, they're fundamentally all the same as each other and equal. But they'd all just, they're in these stupid, cheap Halloween cloaks. And they just, all the stuntmen get, it's easy for the stuntmen because they just put a cloak on and do all the stunts and run about and jump off cars and set themselves on fire and things. And it, but it's so lame looking. It's such a shame.
Yeah. It did feel like very much like the director turned up on the day and someone asked, like, well, what do you want your monsters to look like? Well, they're ghouls, you know, they wear black hoods and capes, right? Just put them all in black monk dresses.
How much talcum powder have you got, guys? We're going to need a lot of talcum powder and a lot of wigs. Yeah, I mean, was this something that made the film crappy to you, or were you like, oh, that's the best thing about it?
It wasn't too bad until they started running and the cloak started flapping. Then I could ignore it until then.
Yeah. It's just a little too cheap, isn't it? That's the thing.
Yeah, they're not... It's like when Matthias is like preaching, it's, you know, it's intimidating. And then when they do stuff, it's kind of funny.
It is ridiculous, so, yeah. Well, we also have the contrast of, even where, like, I think there's a scene where, Neville is rescued, I mean, he gets captured, but he's rescued, and he's riding off on a motorbike with Lisa, who the woman who rescues him. And the stunt double work is... it stands out like a mile. It's just, oh, some young man with a wig. Oh, Charlton Heston is close up. Oh, those people with wigs again. So, you know, a little bit ropey.
I've had a little research, and I think it's rabies rather than syphilis. And then there's also... plagues, where if you were coughing up blood, it looked like you had sucked blood. But I think rabies was the one I was thinking of, because it makes you sensitive to light. You don't like garlic because you can...
All right.
Your senses are so heightened. And if it affects certain parts of the brain, you'll be nocturnal. And you might start biting people because you've become mentally unbalanced.
Oh, so you're saying it's perfectly acceptable science if you call it super rabies?
Yeah, sure.
Russia and China went to war, caused super rabies, and it left. But it killed some people. It's like in the, you know, I don't know. They don't go into explaining why some survive, some don't, apart from Neville. So, yeah, the key beat to this are Neville's having a, you know, lovely meal. He wears his kind of Austin Powers style crushed green sort of, is it green velvet, like his velvet suit with a big poofy neckerchief. And because it's Sunday, and he always dresses for dinner on Sunday, so like he's like a proper mental case having dinner on his own with Julius Caesar. But he's having, you know, he's trying to have peace and quiet playing chess in his apartment at night, and the family are outside, either trying to attack him and his house that he's got, like, barbed wire and all. You know, it's all locked up and he's safe, apart from he keeps the bay windows open all the time. Which is a weak spot for fiery trebuchet-type things. But yeah, I like that Charlton Heston's just, like, in this horrible green suit. And then he's interrupted rudely by... flaming balls coming at his window. And then he just pops out with his big... like, he's got like a gun with a massive big spotlight red light thing on it, so he can shoot a few of them, see them off, and they go... But they're basically just like the rowdy neighbours from hell that he has to put up with, isn't he? So, Abby, I guess you must have felt a bit for... You must have been on side a bit there, because you get a bit annoyed by rowdy neighbours.
I suppose, in retrospect, I did get a small pang of enjoyment out of him firing out of his window and being like, fuck off!
Keep your laughing and you're shouting down your drunks. But, you know, like, his fun has to come to an end at some point. I think we get a bit more fun of him travelling. Like, he goes to a mall and he's like he jogs around and he's making his little notes about where the family might live in the daytime when they're hiding. And he just pops into a dusty ass mall. There's corpses about every now and again, just to remind us it's a creepy Halloween movie. And people are dead. But he's in the mall and he's just trying on different shit tracksuits and be like, oh, I'm not sure that's my colour. And then he just discards them to the ground. And I mean, I did like it. I like that idea that you can just wander through a mall and try everything on, throw it instantly to the ground if you're displeased.
I hated that he was just leaving stuff everywhere. I don't care if it's the end of the world. Fucking tidy up.
You've got banned. So you're going to spend the apocalypse, if you're the only one left, just tidying up, keeping everything nice and squared and tidy.
Putting everything where I fucking want it.
Yeah, on the ground. You're not going to ever, not necessarily going to come back to this mall ever again. There's going to be so many clothes that don't fit you that you won't need them to be tidy and sorted out. This isn't Minecraft, Abby. You don't need to keep a tight ship, keep the creepers at bay. Actually, it is a bit like Minecraft, isn't it? Got a light everywhere, torch it up. So your OCD hasn't gone away in the apocalypse. You're tidying up abandoned sports shops.
Well, I think I'd be probably curating the ultimate wardrobe, where I'd gather things. Like, anything I don't need, I leave behind. Anything else, I take with me. Until I basically have all the clothes in the city that fit me and I could possibly wear in one place.
You'd definitely be going on a little excursion to get all the famous clothes that you've heard of. Like, I don't know if you'd want Queen Victoria's dress or something. Or, like, you'd want to go on a little, oh, I'm going to find famous clothes. I'm going to dress up like a fucking SS soldier because it means nothing now. Or, I don't know, what else would you want? Like Elvis's jumpsuit or Neil Armstrong's astronaut costume or whatever.
So are we working on the assumption that we'll be in America at the time?
I don't know. Well, it'd be difficult to get both Queen Victoria's clothes and Elvis Presley's clothes. Maybe go raid Elton John's house. That'd be a sunglasses treasure trove. All the wigs you could ever want. Anthony, whose house would you be burglaring for their clothes?
For their clothes?
Oh, anything. If you have some other things you perhaps like to, you know, get your hands on.
I don't know. Who's got ridiculous stuff? I might go to, like, technology people, like Elon Musk, see if they invented something secretly.
So all the power's out, but you're trying to charge up special iPhones and things and cars.
Oh, to be super contemporary, Area 51.
Could finally go to an abandoned military test base in the middle of the fucking desert.
Although I think if we were in Britain,
you'd definitely go to the palace. You know, you'd wear some of the whatever's lying around from the Tower of London. Break into that if you can. Maybe take a shit on Downing Street. You know,
that's the thing. I think you're going to have to do a certain investment of time to get past all the security systems.
Well, they'd not work. Well, as long as you don't get locked in. Imagine that. You get locked in the Tower of London and you're the only person alive and you're now a prisoner in one of the world famous prisons and just ravens eating your eyeballs and you're dead. Well, you know, there's any number of things you could do. We definitely all have a cool trip of it, I think. Mm. And you've got time to think. You're not just on a podcast ad-libbing. You've got time to think, what do I want to visit? Where's that prick live? Where can I go? What vehicles can I fuel up or whatever? Anyway.
I was going to say, now that you brought that up, that is something that's generally lacking from this film that most other Last Man on Earth type things do, where they are going around and realising, oh, I'm free to just do or wear or eat or whatever what I want. Yeah. And like they do touch on it in little bits, like the velvet suit was particularly lovely. Mm. But there aren't many of those moments in the film.
Well, at some point you would get tired of it, and you'd settle down, wouldn't you?
It's not a problem, but it's just one of those things that I enjoy from these kinds of movies, and it was just one thing that was lacking. That's all.
Yeah, but like I say, he went to a mall. He's just trying on you can wear whatever you want, Charleston or Neville, and you're just wearing leisure suits. I mean, I get comfort. He always wears practical clothes. He's like in some sort of sporting jumpsuit later on with a military, with Caesar's general's hat on towards the end. And that's quite a good look.
But that's the thing, though, because we've caught him quite late in the game. Presumably he's got all of that out of his system.
Like the guy in The Quiet Earth was wearing dresses pretty quick, so he might have gone through that phase where he was just like a woman new romantic or something, and he just, you know, he could do it every once, and now it's passé.
I was so disappointed when he was in that one mall shop. He looked at all the bloke stuff. He didn't really find anything he liked, and then he started looking at the women's wear, and I was like, yes.
Well, how I interpreted the moment. So he tries on some different. He gets sweaty, and then of course you just wipe your sweat on the clothes you're wearing and throw them away and get a new one. Brilliant. But he was looking at all the mannequins in the clothes shop, and he reaches out as if he kind of fancies, because there's no women or humans around. There's a little moment where he's looking at this mannequin like, I might just give you a little kiss. like he looks like we could be seconds away from him imagining this mannequin being a real woman and who knows what, building a kind of relationship with it, which is often a trope of these kind of mad eccentrics who've been alone in the world. They often fall in love with the mannequins. But that's interrupted by our first human who hasn't got alopecia. There's a weird moment where we see a black...
You don't mean alopecia.
What do I mean?
Albino.
Albinism.
Yeah. Albinism. A part of an egg.
That's the albumen.
Well, anyway, the first non-diseased person who is alive and hasn't presumably had a vaccine against the illness. She is like a foxy-looking black lady with a big afro. She wears a lot of awful brown because it's the 70s.
Mm.
But she's sort of, I don't know, she's like... For some reason, she's caught and is posed as a mannequin and is trying to not be seen by Neville. And then he is perhaps, like, thinks it's a mirage where he's like, oh, I'm fantasying. I'm imagining this woman is real now, you know.
That was the moment when it could have been Xanadu / mannequin.
Oh, my.
And then again, it turned, like...
Yeah, but, you know, he does see this woman, and she runs off, and she's scared of him, I guess, because he's a gun-wielding maniac most of the time. But he's chasing her, topless, lovely. He's topless, I should say. They have a little chase through, like, some of the town and cities looking for her. And then I think he, upon not being able to quite catch up with her, he sort of thinks, oh, I must be fucking out of my mind. He sits down and convinces himself that he's just losing it, doesn't he?
Mm.
I like that aspect. I like the fact that he's not sure he believes it. It's like a nice sort of insight into him. But like, at what point does he get... He just gets like a big wine cellar dropped on him at some point. And he's captured by the family, isn't he?
Yeah, was it just like in a random house?
He's just wandering around somewhere in like a hotel or something, I think. Looking for some fancy booze. But yeah, he does get successfully like ambushed by... Because the thing is, the family, though they don't come out in the daytime, they can hide in their nooks and crannies away from the sun. Mm. And so Matthias's lot have successfully squish-squashed him under a bunch of wine. They kind of jump on him and capture him. And basically just... But he meets... Like, Neville comes face-to-face with this long-haired albino man who, you know, wears sunglasses and a robe. But they basically have their first conversation about where they both stand morally at this point in the apocalypse, isn't it?
Mm.
And it just ends in like a trial where I guess they're going to execute him wearing a dunce's cap in a stadium. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that was an interesting turn.
Big public execution, dunce's cap.
I think that might be the last instance of a dunce's cap in cinema. I can't think of any other time.
And they put him on like a
other
wagon.
Other than animation.
Oh, yeah, of course. But they load him up on a wagon to take him there as well. I don't know. This is meant to be like the old witch trial stuff or something.
Mm. But it's cool. Like, you don't expect them to have, you know, a courtroom and starting to have their own kind of, like, justice system. I liked it as a beat. It's like, oh, this is different. Instead of just, you know, just killing him on the spot, it's like they're getting some sort of sense of justice out of it. It's not quite the same as in the book, where you are kind of like, well, they are kind of justified in putting him on trial and sending him to death kind of thing. It's not so much in this one. You're still kind of on his side.
But Matthias brings up some points and some... Yeah, so he has a relatively acceptable Because he's diseased and all the people around him have died, so they're kind of halfway, there's a sick logic to it. And also you get a sense, like, Matthias is a cult leader, you know, he's partly, you know, preaching to these people and they've bought into it because they either go with this lot or they're left to die on their own, scared and alone, so why not be, it's better to be part of a group. And if the group all believe in no technology and he has his little underlings and things, like there's that Afrod guy who seems to be his right-hand man who seems to occasionally just be like, well, the easiest way to get Neville is to just let me use a gun and I'll get him. So there's a sense, a little sense, it's not a big focus of the film, but there's a sense that this is like, you know, Matthias's thing, it's his big, it is a family, it's a load of people who've united under a way of thinking because of how unfair the world seems to have panned out for everyone. And, you know, once Neville's dead, there is a, you know, potential for things to go smoothly for everyone, even if they are dying. And they don't want to be cured as well. It's not that Neville's offering them a cure at this point, but it's not about that. They see that, as they are now, is the next stage in society, I guess.
You're meant but that's to be this thing, way. The kid who becomes involved later, he goes there saying, like, oh, we have a cure, we can do things. And they're like, I don't want to be cured. It's time for you to die.
At least that's what Matthias wants, so we don't know if the little underlings are privy to being saved or not. But yeah, that's the thing, isn't it?
But we've reached the point of the motorcycle escape, which was quite good.
Mm.
Charlton Heston did a stunt. Did you see?
Well, I saw someone do a stunt dressed as Charlton Heston. It was good. I like that the big floodlights come on, and obviously that spooks all of the light-sensitive baddies. And they kind of, you know, put on the back foot a bit, and then basically a bit of shooting occurs, isn't it? And they end up, like, Lisa's back, this potential mirage that Charlton Heston saw earlier. And basically, with a bit of gunfire and a motorbike, they manage to, like, so she basically untethers him from the stake he's on. And they have a little motorbike sequence to get out, like, in the kind of belly of the stadium, I suppose, isn't it? With a few derpy-looking stuntmen in cloaks diving into the way or out of the way or being on fire or crashing, or isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, the usual, down these stairs from this corner, brum, 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 you know.
Yeah, it did have a sense of, oh, it's time for the getaway action scene. But it was, you know, it was fine.
Yeah, it was needed. Because at the end of the day, this is about having some action and thrills and stuff. You can't just be like a maudlin court case about the moralities of where mankind is right now. You know, it couldn't become 12 Angry Men. That would be a squandering of the concept. You want to see cool, empty locations being fucked around in, so let's do it, I say. But, you know, this is the thing. She reluctantly saves him. She's kind of got a gun on him still. Like, she's kind of, I don't know, does she, like, do, like, a weird, she has a gun on him, but she kick him weirdly, or they get into some sort of kerfuffle.
I thought she pistol-whipped him or something.
Yeah, she's not having it. She's not like, you're going to do whatever you want.
I am so disappointed in her behavioural change as we went along.
Oh, I don't know. She starts, you know, obviously this is a kidnapping as well as a rescue. She basically needs him because her brother is starting to turn white and get the illness.
But that's the thing. She is a self-possessed
survivor.
Heroic person when she rescues him. And then as soon as she gets, like, a little bit of sexy romance time, she forgets everything. She's like, oh no, I'm afraid. Here's a gun. What am I supposed to do with this? You know what you're supposed to fucking do with that. You had one 20 minutes ago.
That is true. It was a big turnaround. I think when she is loved up later in the film, it is, you're right, she does absolutely become a useless woman who just wants to go shopping and doesn't know how to use a gun that we've seen that she can use before. Yeah, it is, at that point, is contrasting. I don't have a problem, however, like, if you're one of the few humans left alive, and you haven't been anyone, I mean, there is a slightly more appealing person, I guess, than Charlton Heston in this universe who's not dying of the plague. But,
well, that's the thing. I don't blame her so much for shagging Charlton Heston. You know, she has, but that said, is she not fucking the other guy?
Exactly. That's what I don't know. But I think, you know, you would sleep with whoever, wouldn't you, if there's a limited number of people. And it's also like a human connection. It's more than just let's have sex because we can. It's like another human, another survivor. There's so few of us. It's such a bleak time. Let's make love. You know, like, I get that. It's fine that she sleeps with him, but she does become a little bit useless and start just, I'm wearing a caftan and I don't care anymore about, you know, now that my brother is saved, it's fine. I'll just be a useless woman, I guess.
It's absolutely infuriating.
Yeah. But before that, as you say, she's feisty and independent, takes him semi-hostage and takes him to a remote kind of one of the mountain they don't have a particularly good place to go, do they? They have like a special bunker with like they have guns to keep away the family, this little group of people. But it's some guy called some young ex medical student called Dutch.
Dutch, yeah.
Dutch is a young man with Lisa. Lisa's like a, you know, fairly young woman as well. And then they have loads of random children, not their children, but like loads of kids of different ethnicities all live with them, and I guess Lisa's brother.
That was an interesting nod to science, because sometimes kids are immune to certain diseases because their immune system is so fresh. So virile.
And there's a sense that they could develop like into it later in life, like any of them can and do. But it's either too small. Or, I don't know, it's weird. I don't really get why there's not enough of justification for why these people are surviving. But they've banded together on the outskirts of the town or city or Los Angeles or whatever. But I wanted their headquarters to be a bit more than just a shitty old few rooms under the ground or whatever they are, you know? It's a bit too vague. They've got, like, sandbags and a gun, you know, to see people off. But it's not like they live in a massive cool mansion or something, which would have been nice. I don't know what you could have done. They could have lived anywhere cool, and they don't. It doesn't make a big fuss of it. It's just, oh, we all survive here. They kind of gloss over it quite quickly. They don't spend that much time there. It's basically, oh look, my young brother is dying and is light sensitive. Oh yeah, he is. We found out that you were a scientist. We know who you are. We need you to save him and come up with an antidote, isn't it? That's their motivation, I guess.
Yeah. And going back to your last point, I just assumed they were far out enough to not be bothered that much by passing ghouls. They seem to have congregated in the city. Whereas, you know, Charlton Heston decided to set up camp right in the middle of them all.
Or that they have kind of got a vendetta. Like, so many of them have been killed by Neville that Matthias has made it a point to try and get rid of him. So that maybe they don't know about them, maybe they don't care. You're right, they're out of the way enough so that they can survive. And they're just a few children, so, and a couple of adults. But yeah, it's again, we get into mental pseudoscience because, okay, he hasn't been trying to come up with an antidote because he can't exactly. He actually does explain that we see in a flashback.
Yeah,
go on.
That he's attempting to administer stuff to one of the
captured
zombies. Yeah, yeah. Family members. And, well, it's pretty much just them having a scuffle for a minute and then him like throwing him at some glass and killing him or something.
Yeah, so he has tried in the past to help or find a vaccine or cure for the few survivors there are. But he's given up. But he's forced into it again, so they take the young boy back to Neville's little pad, just because it's where he works from, I guess. He has access to his sciencey shit, I suppose, for convenience.
Yeah.
It's not to some third lab or anything, or whatever. But yeah, quite quickly he knocks up a reasonable vaccine. Now, this is the thing, it's like, oh yeah, of course, if my blood is the key, because I had this special injection that worked, that's why I'm here, so I'll mix my blood with some sciencey stuff and administer that to you with an intravenous drip or something, and oh look, if it works, then your blood also will become the antidote. And you go, what are you talking about, Abby? You're going to do some science checking here and find out that, oh, actually there is legitimate science behind this logic, behind stuff.
It's less for me, it's less about that and more about, well, obviously, why isn't that the first thing you tried?
Just
like
using,
why is this only occurring to you now?
He didn't have a patient, though, did
well,
he?
Well, he captured a reluctant captive, didn't he? So, family member.
Oh, yeah, he said that. He tried it on someone, but it didn't work.
But then maybe it could have been that this guy had the earlier stages as well. But I don't know, they suggest that it could cure everyone if, you know, it needs to. But anyway, convenience of the plot, and we can't be fucked around forever, I get it. Is this, so we're on to an antidote now for the few people who are alive. And the young boy is coming round and cured, and this is basically an excuse for now Lisa to just... Oh, like, because I think the excuse is Dutch is taking the kids back because they get easily spooked because, you know, they're living in a post-apocalyptic hell world. They get easily spooked. So he's babysitting them back at where they're from. And so Lisa's just staying with her brother and Neville, and now it's like, well, how would you like one of my various canned items I've salvaged, or, you know, some, like, scotch or cognac or whatever you want? I can't quite remember what they settle on. But they basically get boozed up, listen to music and do it, which is, you know, which is good, but then it does change her as a person from then on, as you pointed out, Abby.
I know that if the only two people left on Earth, you're totally going to bang. I know. But there's this part of me that's like, is it all it took? Was just tinned beans and a glass of wine.
It would in the apocalypse, mate. He's the top dog. It's fine. It's fine that they do that. The thing is, it's quite quick. Like, oh, he's fine. My brother's in the other room. Fuck him.
That's it, actually. The fact that her brother is still ill in the other room. It's not like it's just them. She should be worried about it. But no, she's all, no, I'm going to fuck now. Right now.
Gonna wear cool clothes, and we're gonna like, and that's it. It's like, okay, this stuff's working. He's gonna be able, like, so basically, Neville's like, okay, I can donate blood whenever I can. Your saved, better brother now can also donate blood, so we can get this going and get everyone cured and remedied and vaccinated and all this. That's the idea. And then, so like, oh, let's pack up our bags, hit the road, and they kind of have a plan basically to take everything they need to get out of there, away from the hostile family members. And then it's like, oh shit, this is all going to be happy endings all round. But the spanner in the works is that the young boy who's been saved has sort of morals and ethics and cares about, has compassion. He has compassion for the other survivors that are the crazy family diseased people. Because he was one, you know, partly. But also, you know, he sees in Neville, I think they have like a little rooftop discussion about whether they're going to try and save all the family or not. And Neville's like, nah, fuck them. And the boy is like, oh, that's not right. But so he basically decides, I'm going to go and offer the family a cure and see if they want help. And the poor naive bastard just gets murdered, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Sad. What do you guys make of this kind of build-up to the ending here? Because it kind of goes from, oh, we're going to save the day, to, you're all fucked.
My notes start to really thin out then. I don't really have much between Richie going there and Neville getting stabbed in a fountain.
Okay.
I understand why it had to happen to move the story on, but it did feel a bit like, oh, God, really? Is he really gonna do it? It's just one of those. It's one of those things you have in movies where, a lot of the time, in order for the plot to progress, someone has to do something stupid.
You're absolutely right.
And it's one of those moments for me, if you know what I mean. But like, you know, it had to happen, I suppose, because they had to find out that he had a cure and that his threat level had been increased and they needed to get rid of him now.
I think, to my mind, it's like, okay, obviously something stupid has to happen to have some jeopardy. But so Richie's thinking is, okay, you should have compassion, but maybe wait till a few more people are cured. So go back with everyone. And then if you're determined to save the family, maybe once everyone at your sort of survival base has got the vaccine and been, you know that it works and it's fine, then maybe try and send a message to the family, some sort of olive branch to say, if you want to, we can heal you. Obviously, it wouldn't go well because Mathias has his little cult in place. But there might have been a few sympathetic people who are on the outskirts of this cult and just want to live normally again and blah, blah, blah. But of course, he's like, I'll just waltz off on my own. You know, my sister's gone shopping all fucking day and has forgotten about night and day and can't remember that she needs to get back before kind of curfew, before all the bad guys come out. But I guess the thing is she starts to turn white herself. So I don't know if the black turning white is symbolic of some kind of message the film wanted to do. Oh, everyone's turning white, which is intrinsically evil, yeah?
There certainly are, I think, racial undertones, certainly. But I think it's more about how they're all becoming the same homogenized thing, and as a group with power, that can be a little bit frightening.
Yeah, I think it is more mob mentality than like race things, isn't it?
And then they obviously have prejudice then against things which aren't them.
Yeah.
Obviously
relates back to racial tensions as well. But, you know, Lisa's out shopping for cool outfits to be wearing now that she's potentially, I don't know if relationships exist in the post-apocalyptic landscape, but, you know, she's feeling good, they're saving the day. And she spends a long time at the mall. It's basically, in the meantime, stupidly again, Neville has gone off to tell the others, oh, we've succeeded, basically. We're going to come with you guys. Let's all meet up and then head off, you know, somewhere else as a big hippie group of travellers or something. And so Richie's left alone to be a dickhead. And he leaves a note on Caesar's hat and basically gets himself murdered. And so at this point, I guess Neville comes back. It's like he basically pops up and says, yeah, we're all coming and going to live happily ever after. I'll just pop back and get them. Okay, couldn't you just brought them the first time? Why did you need to come tell us and then go back and get them? You know? But and also, I mean, there's a bit of, you know, sense of, oh, don't take care, Lisa. Are you going to be all right on your own in the abandoned world where there's no danger except a few people with hoods who might kill you? So there's a sense of, oh, be careful, don't die on your last day on the job type of thing. But I did enjoy the twist that she put on like a, what's it called, like a headscarf. And then we, you know, that's to hide the fact that she's just clearly turned white. So it's a nice reveal. I didn't hate the idea that Lisa turns at this inconvenient moment. What do you guys think?
I just thought it was strange that she turned.
Well, yeah, it's hard and fast with the rules, isn't it? Like, you can turn at any time, I guess. But a younger brother turns sooner.
Mm.
They don't really care.
It was a little quick, I suppose. But it's different from the book, which is what I was expecting to happen. In the book, like, he meets the only other kind of character is a woman he meets. And, like, he heavily suspects she's a vampire, but then he convinces himself she's not. But then it turns out she is, and she's like a vampire spy. So they kind of do that because she then kind of lets them in, although that's not her purpose in the book.
I do like the idea that, like, from what you're saying, the book idea makes sense. Like, okay, there's a spy, it's one person, it's sort of, you haven't got any logical problems with that necessarily, and the convincing himself and so forth. Mm. But then also, in this, in the Omega Man, basically, she does very quickly turn completely white, and then she's also somehow brain, like, she's sympathized. It's not like, oh, I'm ill now and I don't like sunlight, but I'm still, like, a good person. I kind of go along with what all the other people want now. And it's like, what are you talking about? It's not like Mathias has said anything to you. You just, your disease makes you side with these people, even though you know you've got an antidote. Like, your mind has been affected as well. You're kind of passive now, and you just sort of, you help Matthias's family to get into his house and sabotage him once again. And it's kind of like, well, I don't know. Like, it doesn't make sense that you'd suddenly switch sides as well.
Mm.
Like, I get you'd become ill, but it wouldn't be a problem, would it?
Yeah, I know what you mean, because, like, in the film they have him as a kind of cult leader, and that they're not necessarily naturally this way, but he's kind of influencing them to be, you know, to not like the humans.
The eject technology so, and stuff, yeah.
So yeah, like I suppose it is a bit of a flaw.
But
she just turns straight away.
And but she's essentially a damsel in distress because she can sort of Neville still tries to save her. So you know they all get in and they maliciously smash up all his cool stuff and all of his technology and smash you know his gun rack up and things and you know they smash this cool apartment up, pisses off Neville and basically they could get him. Oh, actually, there is a scene a little bit before this where the Afro sunglasses family member guy he stealthily sneaks a gun. Like, he sneaks a gun into his robe or whatever, against Matthias's wishes. And he basically climbs up the front of the building and gets the jump on Neville and Lisa while the power's out. Like, the power's gone out and Neville has to go deal with it. And so he gets shot in a big exciting bit where, for some reason, oh, Neville's pulled the gun on Lisa, but oh, he'd shoot him because he's come in. And so, you know, there's some threat. I think that's an excuse for them to have sex, isn't it? Like, oh, you saved me, now let's make love and stuff. I'm not a hussy. Oh, yes, I am. Whatever. Violence is, makes me horny, which is always the case. Sorry, but I forgot about that bit. But they have the proper bust-up this time, is the thing. I thought we shouldn't forget about that, because it was quite good. But they get free... What? How does he get free? Just fights them off and pops into the lift with Lisa, is it? Or what was the...
I don't remember offhand, but I remember it being... a bit lame, like one of those things of like, oh, what's that? And runs away, I think.
Oh, no, you don't. You know.
But I don't remember what actually happened.
Do you remember, Abby? How they bust loose?
No.
It was just vaguely lame, whatever the specifics are. Neville grabs Lisa, they go off, get free, they leave everyone else just, you know, beaten up or burnt or smashed in. They're hoping to get away, and maybe they still have time to save Lisa. And Charlton Heston picks up the only remaining vial of his special blood serum, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I guess they also know that Richie was murdered as well. But you know, they're waiting for the others to turn up.
He went back looking for him and found him dead.
Yeah, but they get as far as like this slightly odd fountain outside the apartment that we've seen, just where the mob is sort of attacking the building. And I, you know, they just don't get away in time, isn't it? Like, he essentially, Matthias manages to spear Charlton Heston in the chest or whatever, and then he's like kind of half crucified up against this fountain and just pissing blood into the fountain, and it's all very cool and symbolic. And Lisa's, you know, sort of caught between not knowing what to do and being like ill and stuff. And it's just before everyone turns up, to, like it becomes daytime while Neville's dying.
Yeah, it's. I suppose it's one of those things in movies where they sometimes make the transition from night to day seem really quick, but the way that they edited it at the end, it made it look like he was just standing there dying for hours, just wait for them to turn up, and we're like, oh, here you go then, dead now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bleak ending because you know he's essentially speared in his fountain and dead. But luckily the glass vial hasn't broken, and Lisa just sort of stands about. I guess Matthias can't capitalise on this victory because he's kind of stuck in the building, but also he can't come out in the daylight now. Lisa's just sort of hiding under her cowl or whatever. And then Dutch turns up in his little, 4x4 with all the kids in or whatever, and picks up the last remaining remedy out of Nev's jacket. He's got, and at this point, he's geared up properly. I like that Neville is in his little blue tracksuit, jumpsuit thing with his general's cap on. And I think the little girl rescues the general's hat from the fountain, but then doesn't keep it, just leaves it on the edge of the fountain. I felt like she should have worn it. Like, she's going to be the future leader or something, or I don't know. But just picking it out of the bloody water and leaving it there, who cares? There's any number of disregarded rubbish around the world. But yeah, they you know, the potential is that the remaining survivors, including Lisa, could all, you know, share this remedy and save themselves and go off and live elsewhere happily and drive off into the sunset. Or not, well, the morning, daybreak, I don't know. So it's quite a sad ending. Like, the family still exists, but the human survivors who aren't diseased fully can survive. I mean, what do you think it's trying to say, really, as, you know, as a film?
The final image of him lying down with his arms out, very Jesus-like, in the fountain.
He's died so they could live. Jesus-y myth.
I suppose. I don't think it quite works.
It's not that clever. It's just a little bit of symbolism. He didn't do it willingly. He was like your classic, I'm going to save the day type hero. Well, not classic, but...
Yeah, I suppose. But they definitely willingly made that the last shot of the film.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, it's not as bleak as the book ending.
Oh, yeah, like, he just die.
Well, it's that he is essentially the last person, the last human left on Earth. And then there's a bit of confusion at the end where the kind of not-so-bad zombies come and take out the bad zombies that are, like, surrounding his house. But then he gets scared and misinterprets that, and then they take him prisoner, and then essentially they sentence him to death, and he accepts that. And he accepts that as a fitting punishment for what he's done.
So murdering people.
It's quite different.
Oh, they put Will Smith to death, because I like the sound of that. Is that not how the film works out? I Am Legend.
Yes. Although there's like an alternative cut where he lives. Yeah. Which is technically better, but I know you wouldn't prefer it.
Smith's an Obed.
But yeah, I think, you know, I don't know. It's kind of odd because the symbolism at the end, especially relating to Charlton Heston as a person, because you have him like kind of not gunned down, he's speared down, isn't he?
Yeah.
And his kind of, even though his last act is to get the blood to the people, there's still the sense of, is his dying a bad thing? Like, is this the end of his certain type of violence kind of thing? And then that's topped off by them leaving the war hat with him rather than taking it and extending his legacy, if you will.
Yeah, I guess it's his death's... well, this is the human who was acting somewhat selfishly and killing people. It's just for his own survival. So he's justified, but at the same time, the rest of the group weren't necessarily murdering all of the survivors who were ill. They were just trying to survive themselves. So, yeah, I guess, in a way, it's leaving the last human who selfishly survived, and all the innocent children are kind of going to go and be potentially, like, a different kind of culture that could... They could breed and, like... Breed. But, yeah, they could survive and pass on a new generation of humans, and maybe they'll have a different take on life and won't be so happy to kill in return for surviving and things. I don't know. But let's maybe give the film too much credit where the book might have done some harder work. But yeah, I don't know. It's okay.
It's a fitting ending.
Yeah, I think so. Abby, did you enjoy the conclusion of the movie?
In principle, yes. But like you say, he was bleeding out in that water for a very long time.
He was.
And it was still a bit... I was about to say, do they necessarily know what to do with the serum? But that guy...
Was a medical student.
He was a medical student, so in theory he would be able to continue. Yeah.
And they lost Richie, who would have been the other potential donor. And the sad thing, in a way, is compassion lost out. So Richie represented like a survivor who was compassionate and was brave and selflessly went to meet these people who could kill him, offered them help, and they murdered him. So compassion wasn't the right route, and kind of tit-for-tat violence wasn't the right route. But a different kind of slightly more hippie survivalism might be okay. Like, it's sort of... Like, if you're selfish, you die. If you're nice, you die. Maybe if you're just a more muted mix of the two, I guess. You care, but not that much. You're violent, but not that much. Those are the true survivors, I guess. Or just a bunch of children with a guy looking after them. The world's weirdest dad, the Dutch bloke, like, whatever. I don't know. Maybe they could do a sequel. And then it would be about, Dutch's children or something. Could be more of a Mad Max thing. That'd be fun. I don't know. I don't know what you could do with it, really. What's after Omega?
Nothing. It's the end.
What's pre-Omega?
I don't know my Greek alphabet. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
I'll look.
Zeta? Zeta? Z's quite towards the end.
Yeah, I don't know. It don't, this wouldn't be a
Epsilon? That's in there somewhere.
The Epsilon Man. Isn't that a thing? Well, either way, it doesn't really matter what happens, because it wasn't a legitimate sequel to The Omega Man. It just presented a kind of slightly fun apocalyptic movie with quippy one-liners and silly, corny action and, you know, sex, violence. Well, a little bit of sex. More violence, really. It's just kind of a bit fun and mad. And you know, the budget is sometimes a bit of an issue, but then
It's got a decent pace.
Yeah.
Like, it keeps going, and I never found myself getting too bored or anything.
No, it definitely could have been finessed more and been more, you know, cool, and it could have been higher quality and better, but and made more sense as well. But I liked a lot of it. It's certainly a fun, interesting film. So, I mean, I don't know metaphorically how I feel about it. It's a tricky one to know quite where to go. I don't know if either of you guys have a metaphor that sum up your feelings, but now would be the time.
I don't have a metaphor, but maybe you guys can help me. It's the way I'm coming towards it is that it's been adapted from something I really like, and whilst it's not really anything like it, I still find it okay, if you see what I mean. So it's like, I don't know.
To me, I'm sort of thinking it's a bit like a remedy that has some side effects that you wouldn't want. Yes, you're saved from kind of weird super rabies, but you're going to have, you know, going to shit blood or something. But you're going to live normally, but you're going to, like, there's going to be some horrible, you're going to have horrible wispy hair or cheap, you're going to look cheap and ill. You're gonna look really ill, but you'll survive. Like, I don't know, like, I feel like the film is good, but there's a few little cracks and problems that make it look awful. And it is a bit like when, oh, we can cure your problem, but you're not going to like it that much. There are going to be some drawbacks. And to me, that's what it is. It's like, you've cured one thing and you've caused some other problems here or there. So it's a blessing and a curse. It's better than dying or not watch. Rather watch the film than not. I think it was a good one to, you know, put on. So it's a bit like a remedy. Or like if Charlton Heston's Special Blood Remedy. Yay, I saved you. You're not going to die, but you've got AIDS. So, sorry. We're all going to be a future of HIV positive people. But let's be HIV positive, guys. It was still good.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
So with me, it's some kind of side effect to a vaccine or something.
Yeah, kind of. I'm trying to think of something. I'm trying to think of maybe a food that changed. I don't think that's quite right, though.
Hot dogs, they're nice, but if you think about them too hard, you go, oh, God, that's horrible. I don't know. One metaphor is enough for me, I think.
The only thing I can think of is to do with her character being inconsistent. But it's when you get, like, the big iconic moment in feminism of, like, burning of the bra. And if you actually think about it, well, it's like, well, it's all right for you, who has small breasts in a hot country where you're not going to freeze to death to do that. But there's other people who couldn't possibly do that. You know?
Some people need the scaffolding or the warmth, you're saying.
Yeah. It's like, I don't so much wear mine to port as I do for the heat. It's like, it's a bit like that, where it's like, it's all fine and dandy, unless you actually think about what it's doing. And then it's like, yeah, but no.
Yeah, but no. So you're saying, basically, the film in principle is good, but, practically, it's got some drawbacks and some stuff that's not as good. Like, it's a, yeah, you know.
But well-meaning.
Yeah.
As well.
Historically, I think when hippies were burning their bras, they're actually, I think the original sort of big, the thing that snowballed in the media was actually people binning their bras as well. It wasn't like lighting them on fire. That was like a thing that came a bit later.
But still, did you just plug your thing in?
No battery.
Okay.
Did we find out what the thing is with Omega? Is there other?
Yeah. I have the whole alphabet here.
Okay.
The one before Omega is Psi.
Psi. Maybe that's a good metaphor. The whole film is a bit.
I'll go from top to bottom.
The best bits.
I apologise, listener, for my terrible pronunciation of some of these. But here we go. Alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, zeta, eta, theta, iota, kappa, lambda, mu, nu, xi, omicron, pi, rho, sigma, tau, upsilon, phi, chi, psi, omega.
That sounds just like nicknames for Pokemon, to be honest.
It did.
Anyway, I don't know which one of those type mans I'd want to see. I don't know which one of them. I will say, the whole thing, I mean, it's a little awkward. How do you pronounce the O of omega? It's sort of a weird omega sign, is it not? I know, also calculators, those are the other things that use these terms. But I don't know. Like,
I think one of the things that sums up possibly our feeling is the actual description with kappa, and it's K, as in English, but completely unaspirated.
Unaspirated?
Yeah. Which I don't know what that means, but I feel like it expresses something.
I'm more baffled now. If anything. Well, it's all Greek to me. Let's just end the podcast, shall we? Like the end of the world. It just finishes with a not so much with a bang, but a squib.
What's the thing about not a bang, but a whimper? What's that?
That's it. That was what I was thinking of. Not so much with a bang, but whimper. Sigh. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Ciao for now.